Boy, Chet, there could not have been a better song to lead into what I'm about to say. This is my story. This is my song. I am so blessed is the only word I can usually, I can actually think of that fits this, to know your stories. I'm kind of uniquely positioned to really kind of get to know everybody. And that's a neat thing here. I can remember when Rhonda and I, we're even just looking at the job, at the possibility of moving out to Trophy Club and being here with you wonderful folks. And they sent us, the search committee sent us out to lunch with the Boggs and the Biggers. You know, that was, I guess, to show us the best of Lake Cities. I don't know. Or the Biggs and the Boggers, as I like to call them. You know, whatever. They're kind of interchangeable. And we sat over at Chili's and we just heard each other's stories. And it was a few weeks after that we were still kind of trying to place everybody. And Rhonda was talking to another member here, and she said, "Oh yeah, we met this family. I don't remember their last name, but he played college baseball. He was a baseball player. The baseball player, you know who I'm talking about." And they gave Rhonda the blankest look. Well, she's talking about Dave, you know. And you don't think about Dave. You don't look at Dave and think baseball player, do you? Well, if you'd known him when Sharon met him, you would, right? And so they had no idea. They'd known Dave for years and not known that he played college baseball. And it's just a kind of a neat thing to find out about each other's stories. Had the same experience with Daryl. Daryl, come on up. This is Daryl Tucker. Daryl and Kim. Kim, give a wave. There she is. Hey, Kim. And Tyler, you can wave too. You don't have to, though. They're relatively new. When I say relatively new, they placed membership a year ago. But Daryl and I were visiting and talking and sharing stories with each other. Now, the best way to do this, by the way, is over a plate of barbecue, how the Lord intended. Amen. Are you on, by the way?
I think I'm on.
You are on. Have a seat.
Good.
And Daryl was just kind of sharing with me his faith story and how God has used him and moved in their lives in the last, now you and Kim have been married 21 years, is that right?
That's correct.
By 1995. And there was something really compelling and captivating about Daryl's story. And so I said, what would it look like if maybe we just dialogued a bit? And you could tell how that came to pass and this really exciting mission that I think evolved in the life of your family. Okay, so let's take it back. You and Kim are married in 95. You're a blended family.
We are blended.
She has two girls. You have two girls. What are their ages then?
They were 5 and 6. My two were 5 and 6. Hers were 5 and 6 when we married. So we were kind of like a Brady Bunch on estrogen.
Yeah. Now, later in the story, God will bless you with a son, but that's for later. Right now, let's say you kind of had it on your heart. You knew that you wanted to go into ministry. This wasn't something that you just sprang on her after you were married, but you decide you feel this strong call to go into kind of organized ministry, and so that leads you guys to preaching school. Where are you at in the story there?
Well, that's not exactly true.
Okay, come on.
Although I wanted to be in ministry when I was in high school, I wanted to be in youth ministry and maybe college ministry. I kind of got out of that when I was in college and got into the business mindset and worked in wholesale and retail, and I've worn a lot of hats. When she met me, I was in wholesale. And but because of certain things in my life, we moved up to Colorado, and I was in the mortgage business for a year or so, and I really became convicted to go into ministry. It was a new conviction of the old conviction.
Okay.
And so we went to Bear Valley in 1999 through 2001. I graduated in 2001.
You guys graduate, and you're thinking, what is ministry going to look like for you?
Well, you know, when you graduate from preaching school, there's a lot of different directions that you can go. And we were looking for a church where I could preach full time. I wanted to be in full time preaching at that point. And there just wasn't what we wanted. But as I was looking for jobs, I saw one for Christ Haven Home for Children as house parents. And Kim and I looked at that and we thought, you know what, we could do that. And so I called up Christ Haven, and James Satterwhite was the director then. And James said, well, We've got an opportunity. It's the teenage boys' cottage. At that point, our girls are all in high school. They're teenage girls, four of them. And we thought that would be like throwing kerosene on a fire.
Yeah.
And so we thought, no, we'll wait. We'll wait this out. And I took a secular job. They moved us down here. We were close to all of our girls and everything. And I got into ministry down here. The understanding when I took the job with my college roommate owns this company, America's Best Sports Photography, and I work for them now. But back then, he hired me and brought me down as his marketing director, and I told him, I said, if there's a ministry job, I'm going to take it. And he said, that's fine. I need you now. And so we came down, and about a year into it, there was a ministry position available, and so I started preaching at the Hilltop Church in Roanoke, and we were looking for some different service projects, things that we could do with our young marrieds, and I knew that Christ Haven had some different activities going on, and we thought, well, let's get involved with that. And so I called up James, and he said, you know what, we talked a long time ago, it wasn't that long, it was a couple years, but he said, and we've got a opportunity again for house parents, but they're relief parents. And so the kids, you'll be in a cottage and the kids can come to your cottage, and that gives the other house parents a relief week. So we were like, well, that wouldn't be too bad, because we could have the teenage boys once every 6 weeks. And
you could manage the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it wouldn't be so bad.
We could keep a fire hose.
There you go. And, which is good to do anyways. I mean, yeah, really.
With boys, yes.
Parenting tip.
So we went ahead and we went through the interview process and were hired as relief house parents. And we'd been there, oh, maybe 6 months when the teenage boys' cottage, of course, was at our cottage that week. And their house parents quit.
Wow.
And actually, that was the second set of house parents that they'd had since we had been there. It's teenage boys are tough, y'all. especially when you can have up to eight of them at a time.
Wow.
And so here they were at our cottage already. And, of course, the management at Christ Haven says, well, we're looking for house parents to replace them, but you know, we kind of like you guys, and we'd like to see you be the house parents for these teenage boys. And so they said, look, we got this brand new, really nice cottage that we just got built. It's designed for the cottage, for the teenage boys, and let's put you in there. And so we said, reluctantly, this has got to be God's plan, because he's stuck us with these teenage boys every time we turn around. And so we said, all right. I was pretty excited about it. I don't know how Kim felt about it. I think she had dread in her heart. But God really worked in a lot of different ways for that.
Now, Daryl, the average stay for house parents is what?
It's about 2 years. That's what their track record is. Huh. Nationwide, it might be less than that. Foster parenting is hard work.
Right. And these kids, it's just, if nobody knew what Christ Haven was, these kids are coming out of what? Broken homes, difficulty, you know, what do we have going on?
They come from so many different backgrounds. Usually they've been pushed from one family member to another because, you know, mom or dad is in jail, they've been split up, there's drugs involved sometimes, there's abandonment issues. We had one set of, I think there were four or five of them that had been living under an underpass over in Tyler, Texas when they got brought to Christ. I mean, they're all voluntarily placed back then. CPS wasn't involved, but CPS was definitely on the picture.
Right.
Chris, one of our boys that came to us, he had lost his dad, his dad and sister in a fire a few years before he came to us, and his mother had some real severe health problems, and he lost her, and that's when he came to us.
So you guys wind up staying how long?
We were there for 8 years
before
my dad got terminally ill, and we left to go and help out.
And over the course of 8 years, how many kids come through?
32 boys lived with us during that 8 year time period. Huh. Now the average stay for kids at Christ Haven, they normally wash out about every 3 months. That's kind of the stay. Our boys, we were keeping them on an average 18 months. Now we still had a couple that we had one that washed out in 3 days.
Wow.
He just didn't want to be there and wasn't going to be confined there and wasn't going to follow the rules. But we had some others that had no place to go. But what they really needed was somebody to embrace them and just let them be kids. Take the, you know, for some of them, they were the oldest sibling and they have younger sibling. And so they're being the mom or the dad. They're performing responsibilities that they shouldn't have to do. But there's nobody there to really care about them or to mentor them and help them through it.
Give us an example that you saw. I know you saw some kids that didn't stay, didn't stick, but you had some really great successes there.
Yeah. You know, I talked about Chris. Chris is still one of our kids. You know, he came to us when he was, what, Kim, freshman in high school? Freshman in high school when he came to us. Just him and his dog. And he had this poor pug that, the pug didn't make it just because his health was just so bad. And so it's just one more loss for Chris. But what we saw with Chris was, you know, he had such artistic tendencies and ways that he needed to let loose of all of his pain. So we were able to encourage him and put him in situations at school and other places to help encourage him to release some of that pain. And today he's still one of our kids. He still comes home and you know, on holidays and different times. He and his wife live in Roanoke. He's a mechanic.
Well, and I have to laugh because he refers to these kids as his kids. And so when I asked him, so tell me about your family. He's like, well, I have 32 sons, you know. And I was like,
oh, that's not true. 35.
I was like, okay, easy there.
Because we have Tyler.
I think I grabbed the silverware and just pulled it towards me and said, none for you. but you were telling me about kids that came to Christ and that you've stayed in contact with. Tell me about one in particular that's still locally here. You were, I cannot remember his name.
Chris. This is one of them that came to Christ. I baptized, I think, three of our boys, and there were at least three others that were baptized when they went to camp. They went to Sooner Camp and other camps through the help of Pilot Point Church of Christ that helped to scholarship them to get them to go to camp in the summertime. And you know, we found ways to introduce them to Jesus and to be the hands and feet of Jesus. You cannot be in foster parenting and not approach it with a mindset of ministry and love that says, I'm going to be God's hands and feet.
Yeah.
And so you get to talk to them, and they get to see love and joy. It was funny. There were a couple of different ones that commented to Kim and I, do you guys ever fight? you know, it's, yeah, I just told them, sometimes we don't agree, and we work through it.
And imagine what they had seen.
Yes.
The kind of interaction that they had seen with a married couple or with somebody who was just in relationship. And then, you know, comparing that to you and Kim, I imagine that was just night and day. Real quick, I know we're short on time.
Are we?
We. Well, I do have a sermon over there, but we don't have to get to it.
Well,
we can put that away for next week, and then I don't have to do anything all week.
But not like the Cowboys are playing today. So.
That's true at noon. I wanted you to talk about how you had some other people kind of come in and be really important in the lives of these kids. And what I was really driving us to is this idea of how we can be involved more than just sponsoring or sending money. But talk about people that really showed up in the lives of these kids outside of being a house parent.
You know, when I think about it, the one that really showed up in their lives was God. Now, God shows up in a lot of different ways. For David Rolls, one of our boys, he had lost, his parents were divorced and terrible relationship with his father. His mother had been wounded, become a paraplegic through a bad drug situation. He and his two brothers had been tossed around a little bit before they came to us. He came to our cottage, his two brothers, they were with the Smyerses across the way from us. And incidentally, some of the house parents that are there at Christ Haven, they've been there 19, 20 years.
Wow.
There are some who really stay and stick a long time. And Terry and Peggy are one of those couples. But when David came to us, he had been part of ROTC. And so there were people in the ROTC program at the high school who really kind of were an integral part of David's life. But in addition to those people, we had David and Janet Tatum, who, you know, I think all the time people are saying to folks at Christ Haven and other foster facilities like that, children's homes, how can we help? Well, what David Tatum did, David was a pilot as well as being a contractor and a lot of other things, but David and Janet took David Rolls, one of our boys, and he mentored David. He took him up in his airplanes.
Wow.
And showed him that there was so much more that he could become.
Yeah.
You know. So David at this point, he's been in the military, he's tested and he's Army Ranger now.
Wow.
He's gone through part of that program. I think he's still got some other things to do if he goes with it, but he's stationed down in the Austin area now. But I can tell you right now, David would have washed out if it hadn't been for the Tatums mentoring him, taking him into their home. We had one family that they found out the boys and I were, I was going to help them kind of have their own business where they could go out and they could mow lawns. Is this me?
I don't know.
They were going to mow lawns, and that was the way they wanted to make.
You now had three jobs.
But it was an amazing way for somebody to just jump in and help. People all the time want to be helpful, but they don't know how. There's a ton of different ways. You know, everybody gets helpful around the holidays.
I was gonna say.
Christmas comes and oh, we all get bleeding hearts and we want to help. And that's great, okay? I'm 100% on board, but it's the people who give throughout the year.
Yeah.
Find little ways, sports tickets to sporting events or money to help with clothes for school and maybe gift cards to buy presents at birthdays. Or
right.
There's just so many different ways to help if you're just a little creative. You don't have to put your entire life into helping God's children, but you can do it and live it, and it can be a part of you, and you can be thinking about it, and you can pray about it.
Yeah. Well, and I love, part of your story is just kind of the seasons that God had in store for you, that there was a time where it was kind of, you know, organized ministry in a church and it looked like that, and there was a season where you guys are living there at Christ Haven, and there's a season that you're not, but God is throughout all of that. He weaves all of that together. I appreciate you sharing. I know I do have to get on to the sermon, but can we just thank Daryl for doing this? Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Love you. If you have your Bible, Psalm 139, this is just fits perfectly with where I wanted to go. We were going to do that on Orphan Sunday, and I knew we needed a little bit more time than that Sunday allowed. And so I really want you to hear his story and how that really fits in with this image that we're going to get of God this morning in Psalm 139. In Psalm 139, in fact, I just want to read this. We're going to start, I'll give you the first six verses, and we're going to kind of take it a chunk at a time. You've searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. If there's a picture that emerges from Psalm 139, and I had this image, I don't know if you've ever seen, back when they used to have to develop film, and we didn't have just digital cameras, but have you ever watched an image on a piece of photographic paper? They bathe it in chemicals, and kind of slowly the image starts to emerge, and then all of a sudden you get this full, clear, you know, brilliant picture. If there's a picture that emerges from Psalm 139, it's this. It's that David depicts God. His depictions of God are in some ways scientific, in some ways poetic, in some ways poignant, in other ways bracing, in some ways unimaginable and indescribable. But the picture that we get of God is contained in the words of verse 6. It's just too much. It's too lofty. It's too wonderful. It's too high. It's too awesome, we would say, for me to imagine. That Hebrew word there, when he says, you've searched me, God, is literally to dig. And I love that. It says that God digs you. That's a 70s way of saying God understands you. He gets you, man, you know? But he says he's dug into you. He's examined you. You've searched me, God, and you know me. He doesn't just know you on a kind of a, you know, a surface basis. He knows you deeply. He knows you intimately. He says, you know my beginning, middle, and end. You know my past, my present, and my future. You know from when I started, you know where I'm walking now. You know all the seasons of my life, even before they've unfolded. In Hebrews 4, we read in verse 13, nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare to him to whom we must give account. And in some ways, that idea of being laid bare before God is as terrible and frightening as it is comforting and soothing. To be known by God, intimately known by God, on some days, maybe on my best days, sounds really inviting. It sounds really relaxing. And then there's other days that I say, Lord, could you just not see me today? Could you just turn away? Because I don't want you to know me when I'm at my worst. God is the worst person to shop for. I wrote this down. God is the worst person to shop for. He has everything, and he's never surprised, you know? When God opens up a gift that you give him, he's like, yeah, I knew that's what it was. He's a present guesser is what he is. He looks at us, and he knows us, and he still loves us. I love this phrase. It says, before a word is on my tongue, Lord, you know it completely. One of my friends is a preacher. He said, wouldn't it be great if we could get an email from God? Maybe if he would just send an email once in a while that would say, hey, Ken, Friday at 2:38 p.m., don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut. Use duct tape if necessary. Signed, God. Wouldn't those be great to get? Some of you are going to send me that email, and you're going to say, hey, Jeff, Sunday morning, 10:30. But the image that we're getting, the image that's emerging as we're developing this picture of God is a God who knows us, a God who is before time and in time and over time, right? And he says in verse 7, basically he says, where can I go? Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The light will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Not only does God know everything, but he is everywhere. So this picture that we're receiving of God is one that elevates who God is. David is saying, this is a great God. There's no place that we can go. No place that we can go that he can't find us. No place that we can arrive at that he won't reach us. I love the way how Paul writes about it in Colossians. In Colossians 1, verse 16, he says, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and him all things hold together. Now there he's talking about Christ, but we can expand that to be who our God is. Everything holds together. David elevates God. He gives us a right-sized view of God. But look at the next section. This next section, not only does David want us to see how amazing God is, he wants you to realize how amazing you are. In verse 13, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you." That phrase there, when he says intricately wrought, that's the phrase that comes out in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, it's really one word, and it's the word for embroidered. Okay, guys, we need a little bit of a primer on what embroidery is. It's that really fancy, fine stitching, right? It's the tiny little stitches that are added to cloth to make it beautiful. It's something that's very fancy. It's something that's very delicate. It's something that's very precise. And that's the word that David uses here. He says, when you put me together, when you knit me together in my mother's womb, you embroidered me. You made of me something beautiful and something intricate. Any of us that understands the inner workings of our organs and our cells and our molecules, we understand that we are intricately woven together. I love this when he says, "You saw me, you saw my unformed body." Do you see that there in verse 16, that unformed? You know what that word in Hebrew is? It's literally my rolled up substance. When you think of the rolled up substance of somebody, don't you see that picture that really we only have from modern technology of what that baby looks like in the womb, that rolled up? How in the world did David know that? How in the world could he have written that at this time and said, "In my rolled up substance, you made me"? I love the way Augustine writes. He says, "Men go abroad to wonder at the heights of mountains, at the huge waves of the sea, at the long courses of the rivers, at the vast compasses of the ocean, at the circular motions of the stars, and they pass by themselves without wondering." Augustine says, if you just look inside of you, you'd see the beauty of a sunset. You'd see the vastness of a sky full of stars. Psalm 139 not only elevates God, it elevates us. It says that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that you are stitched together, that you are God's masterpiece. In Ephesians, listen to how Paul tells us about who we are. "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in the heavenly realms with every spiritual blessing in Christ. For he chose us in him," when? "Before the creation of the world. He chose you before you were ever knit together, before you ever took a breath, before you ever took a step, before you ever said a word. God chose you, and he chose you to be holy and blameless in his sight. In love, he predestined us for adoption." That should tell you how precious you are to God. You know, in the early church, God's people became family to those who had no family. That idea of what Daryl shared with us this morning, that's a long tradition in Christ's followers. You see, in the Roman culture, there was this practice when a baby was born. The baby was set at the feet of the father, and if he picked up the child, the boy or girl was then legitimized. He was accepted. She was accepted. She became part of the family. Babies that were not picked up, maybe because they looked weak, were outcast, often taken outside of the city to designated places where they would die of exposure or from wild animals. It was the first century church, the first group of Christ followers, who said, "You are wonderfully, intricately made. You are so precious to God that we will not let one perish. And so they went out and they brought those babies back, adopting them into their own families and putting pressure on the Roman government to outlaw the practice. Do you know when kids were adopted in Greek culture in the first century? It wasn't until they were adolescents, which is kind of a dicey proposition when you think about it, because who in the world wants a teenager in their house? I mean, really, right? They're moody. They have an odor. You know, they're really high maintenance. But what were the Greeks thinking? They were thinking by the time they were adolescents, you could see some things in those kids. You could see if they were useful for something, if they had a skill. Maybe they had learned a trade. Maybe they were really strong. Maybe they were really good looking. And so they would base the value, they would set the value of a person's life on who they had become as a teenager. God help us. But David says, no, in the womb, in the secret place, you're precious to God. God elevates our worth by saying that we have the same rights and the same riches as the son of a king. And then Psalm 139 gets weird. It takes a turn, as many of the Psalms do. And look at verse 19. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. What? We just had this beautiful picture of babies and streams and mountains and all this great stuff, and now you want to talk about slaying the wicked. Okay. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. David elevates God. He elevates ourselves, who we are as people, as mankind. But then I believe this last section, he elevates our pursuits. He elevates the work of our lives, the things that we do. He says, I want to love passionately the things that God loves passionately. And the way that he gets it, it gets to this is through this emotion of hate. He says, Lord, I want to hate the things that you hate. Now notice that he does not say, I want to hate the people that you hate. Because what does God hate? He hates sin. He hates sin in the way a surgeon hates cancer. He hates sin in the way an epidemiologist hates viruses. He hates sin in the way a parent hates laziness, right? We want our kids to, we know that's only going to work something, that's not going to be for their benefit. He hates what sin does to his people that he has intricately woven together, that he has called priceless. And so David says, would you, and there's images of this earlier in the text. He says, would you put your hand on me, God? And would you guide me? And would you lead me in the way everlasting? Now, when we hear the word hand of God, that probably does not conjure up a nice warm handshake or a loving, you know, hand on your shoulder. The hand of God most often sounds like the right hand of God, right? Of his power, of his might, of his ability to smite. And so for some of us, being close to God is I love how one commentator wrote, it's as burdensome as it is beautiful. Because we understand that the hand of God, we cannot flee from his hand. That darkness does not overwhelm him. But why would we flee from something that's beautiful? Because for some of us, the thought that God lurks and works even in dark places is terrifying. It's burdensome. But if there's one thing that I want you to remember about this image that we receive of God, this picture that we receive of God, is that God is even in hell. He's even in this place that they call Sheol, down in the depths. It's the closest thing in the Old Testament that we would have to what we would call our understanding of what hell is. And why in the world would we want God to be in hell? It's because I want to know that there's absolutely no place that he won't go to save me. That God is present, yes, in the hell of war. That God will go and be present in the hell of cancer, in the hell of broken promises and broken relationships and broken marriages and broken kids. God will go to that hell. The fact that we have such a difficulty perceiving in God in these situations, it doesn't change the reality that we were perceived by God, that we're seen, that we're heard, that we're known, and that His hand is on our lives. And so we say this morning, may we, like God, elevate the lives of those around us. And may we find the places where we can go with Him, yes, even into the hells of this world, and shine light, and spread grace, and love kids, and feed hungry folks, and give blankets to people who are cold, and share the word of the Lord with the people of the Lord who need the grace of the Lord. May it be so this day and every day. If you have a spiritual need this morning, would you come as we stand and sing?